Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. I'm always surprised by educated, health-conscious people who buy products or foods with convenience as their first consideration, instead of whether the product is safe, or the same people who don't question authority when they're faced with pronouncements based on labels like natural, low-fat, cholesterol-free, or even organic. I know it's hard to stay up on the latest research, since that's what I do for a living. I also know that even if you try, there are confounding contradictions that make these decisions situational and personal. Still, there may be some principles to apply when facing statistics and propaganda. Today, we examine some factoids about our modern toxic load and rediscover some basic rules for protecting our detoxification pathways and our overall health. We're joined today by the author of The 100-Year Lie, How Food and Medicine Are Destroying Your Health, Randall Fitzgerald. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. Dr. Joseph Mercola says on his website that research from Italy shows, quote, once and for all, unquote, that aspartame is toxic. The New Scientist magazine, on the other hand, reports that after reviewing the research, the European Food Safety Authority, and following it, the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S., gave aspartame a, quote, clean bill of health, end quote. Who's right? In my opinion, neither one. Although Dr. Mercola is right to warn readers off aspartame, he crosses from science to religion or marketing when he claims this or any other study proves anything, quote, once and for all, end quote. In science, once and for all lasts just as long as it takes scientists to put together a body of research that reveals new facts or changes our explanations for the facts we observe. The European Food Safety Authority and the FDA just didn't understand the research. The study, reported in the March issue of Environmental Health Perspectives, was conducted at the European Foundation of Oncology and Environmental Sciences, referred to as the Ramazzini Foundation, an independent nonprofit research institution. Dr. Mirando Soffriti, the director of the foundation, and his colleagues fed laboratory rats aspartame-laced food at concentrations from very low to very high. They discovered that at doses far below current standards, the test animals developed malignant tumors, including lymphomas and leukemias. Upon examination, the European Food Safety Authority, and with it the FDA, dismissed these findings. An example of their reasoning was that the tumors were explained by the high levels of background lung inflammation. Dr. Soffriti responded by saying that this comes from a principal strength of his research methodology. The rats in Ramazzini studies live a full life. At their natural death, they are examined. In contrast, typical studies, quote, sacrifice, unquote, the test animals after 2 years. 80% of cancers in people occur after the age of 55. Allowing test animals to live out their lives was not only more humane, it enabled the aspartame to run its full course. Rats, just like humans, are more prone to inflammation as they age. It is not a reason to reject the Ramazzini findings. In my view, and that of many others, this is science of the highest quality. The European Food Safety Authority and the FDA just didn't want to believe what they saw. Very, very much, they didn't want to believe it. And Dr. Mercola did. We all have things we want to believe and things we don't want to believe with varying degrees of desperation. If you believe Antonio Damasio, as I do, we can't think straight if our ideas didn't have some juice. The trick is to avoid being a captive of those desires and watch out for those who are captives of what they want to believe. It's not good science. For a copy of this transcript, go to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Thanks, Jeff. Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, Ph.D., is an environmental economist. He's a writer and a health educator who works with individuals. He co-produces this radio show and is editor of our quarterly, The Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine. You can reach him by going to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, or you can call him at 707-874-1496. And now to our guest, Randall Fitzgerald, has been a newspaper reporter, magazine editor, and book author for 36 years. His first job out of the University of Texas at Austin Journalism School was as an investigative reporter for syndicated columnist Jack Anderson in Washington, D.C. During the Reagan administration, Fitzgerald co-wrote a presidential commission report on reforming the federal government. He's written investigative feature articles for The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and for 20 years was a contributing editor for Reader's Digest. He's co-authored 6 previous books, and he lives in Northern California, and we welcome you to the show.
Yes. Thank you very much.
I'm tempted to ask you questions about politics, but I think I want to do that after we get into the show a bit. I think it's a funny way to start. I think a better way to start is... what's clear from your book is that your orientation is toward consumer responsibility, that people should be informed, and you've done a really good job of culling a lot of very good research on the topic of toxins invading us in various ways, and you've also cited a lot of different people that I like and done a very good job of doing that. But I think what your point is that if people are educated about this, they can make some good consumer decisions and possibly also put some pressure where it needs to be put. A good example of how pervasive the problem of consumer apathy is this, if you can describe in the beginning of the book the sign at the entrance of Walmart, who is apparently going organic. Do you need to look it up in the book to read it, or do you have it memorized?
I don't have it memorized. I can look it up.
Yeah, look up the sign and read it. It's right at the very beginning. I think I even marked it if you don't find it fast enough. But it's sorry, I should have just had it ready for you. Oh, you've got it. Okay, so read the sign. This is a prominent sign as you go into Walmart.
It says, "Warning. Products sold or used on these premises may contain chemicals known to the state of California to cause cancer, birth defects, or other reproductive harm."
And you actually at that point talked to some of the greeters, you talked to people in the store, you talked to honchos. What was the reaction? Describe what happened when you started talking to people.
I was curious about the sign. I had seen it. I'm not a Walmart shopper by nature, but the times that I've been to the store, I had seen the sign, and I was curious about it. And for the purposes of this book, the research phase, I decided to make a few inquiries. And I stood outside of a Walmart store and watched people go back and forth past this sign for a period of an hour, and no one even glanced at the sign. And the sign is prominently displayed. It's right next to the entrance. You can't miss it. It's the size of a magazine cover. And yet people were going back and forth as if it had nothing to do with them. So finally I started questioning people. I would point the sign out, and I would ask, well, what do you think this sign means? And the sort of answers I got ran the gamut, but basically people thought it was a liability thing, that if someone got sick inside the store, that somehow this would give Walmart the opportunity to say, we have no responsibility. And this was an attitude that struck me as rather strange. I could understand the argument, but I wanted to inquire further, so I talked to some Walmart employees and eventually some people in the corporate offices of Walmart to find out what the sign meant. And they were puzzled that I would even be asking questions because, according to the people I spoke with, no one had ever asked questions about this sign before. Which also seemed very strange to me. And in fact, the Walmart executives I spoke with didn't even know the origin of the sign. They thought it was a federal mandate. In actuality, it was because of Proposition 65, which had been passed by California voters in the 1980s, that would require any public facility to post this notice warning people that there could be chemicals inside that could be harmful to health. So as a result of reaching a number of dead ends, I could not even find from Walmart exactly what chemicals they were referring to in connection with the sign. I decided to use this as the opening anecdote to the body of the book because it best illustrates a key point. That is, there are warning signs around us everywhere. Most of them are invisible, and most of them are dependent upon our judgment and our intuition in order to decipher their meaning.
One of the things that's also clear from both your experience with the sign and your writing of the book is that whoever is supposed to be overseeing all of this is not doing a very good job, because there is a lot of lying and cheating going on. It really does always remind me, and I've been watching Deadwood, you know, these old episodes of Deadwood, and I realize over and over again the origins of how law is created in this country, and it's still Deadwood. I mean, it's still like cowboys, you know, who are just getting away with whatever they can. Because we have, I mean, here we have a sign which people are actually ignoring. So here's one instance where people are being warned. I mean, you, as you say, if you walk into Walmart, there's a smell that hits you, and it isn't popcorn only that you're smelling. You're smelling formaldehyde and all kinds of other chemicals that are in there, and fragrances. So, as you say, there's more than just sun, but even here's a sign, here's regulation where it's working, and people are ignoring it. The other problem is that when things are labeled, there's shenanigans going on with the labeling. Like, tell us about what unscented or fragrance-free means. This is really frightening.
It is. I was concerned about all of us having access to relevant information. If we're going to protect ourselves individually and not rely upon any institution, then we need access to accurate information, and we need wide access to information. So I began looking at trade secrecy laws. As most everyone knows, if you look on the label of most any product these days, you will find certain generic classifications, such as fragrances, or the word natural, and my favorite is the word inert. And what does inert mean? Well, manufacturers say, oh, we put the chemicals in these products, but they don't really do anything. Well, of course these chemicals do something, and of course their presence is meaningful. But what does it really mean under trade secrecy laws to have these labels? According to manufacturers, it means that we are protecting the ingredients of our products from our competitors. But in this day and age, any corporation that has the money to produce a product can back engineer a competitor's product to determine what ingredients are in it. So it's really not a legitimate argument to say that trade secrecy is designed to protect product ingredients from competitors. What trade secrecy laws do is protect ingredients, especially toxic chemicals, from the prying eyes of consumers, from those of us who buy the products and are subject to the harmful effects of many of these chemicals that are now legally laced into a wide range of products.
So what does unfragranced and unscented mean?
It simply means that chemicals have been added to obscure the aromas of other chemicals that are in the product.
This, of course, makes me nuts because I am sensitive to fragrances. So this makes me insanely, you know. So, and do you see this happening across the board? Are you seeing this only in large commercial brands who are putting out unfragranced products like Tide, which has, incidentally, if people don't realize this, the fragrances that they put into laundry products, as an example, contain some of the most cancer-causing chemicals ever known. All these three-ring, benzene ring, horrible things, because natural fragrances only last a few hours. So these are fragrances that linger for, I can testify to this, maybe as much as a year with repeated washings after you stop using the product. So these are not natural fragrances. If they're using a masking agent, anyway, it's very frightening because the people who get sick from these fragrances are getting poisoning reactions. They're not getting an allergic reaction. So, what I'm asking, I guess, is if you go into a health food store and you buy one of these so-called these products that claim to be earth-friendly, and they say that they are not using artificial scents, can we even begin to believe this? I mean, how do you ever figure out what to use and what not to use? I mean, some of us have a nose where we can feel whether there's something, but not everybody's able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm certainly not sensitive enough to be able to sense the presence of these lingering fragrances. And I think in general, most people don't know and can't know. It's a risk. Everything about the products we use, and this was very mind-opening for me up until 2 years ago, I had never taken much interest in this particular subject area, in the relationship between synthetic chemicals and health. I had been in a state of denial, much as I talk about in the book, most people being in states of denial. It was only as a result of seeing a pattern of health problems among my friends and among members of my family that I began to ask what turned out to be the relevant questions about these associations.
That's a very important thing that you just brought up, and it makes me ask you then, what are the relevant questions for a consumer to ask? I mean, the only thing that I can think of that one could do in this situation, which is what I do, is that I kind of look into the company a little bit when I'm buying something on a regular basis from them. I look into what their practices are like, and I make a sort of judgment call, because even if they disclose their ingredients, for instance, there are some products that are touted as being so natural you can eat them, and yet what's really going on when you talk to, for instance, personal products, someone who works as a chemist in the personal products industry will tell you that there are rules about the way that you're supposed to disclose your ingredients. So if you say something like coconut fatty acids, that is not correct labeling, because they are, in fact, removed. These are synthesized chemicals. These aren't natural. This is not squeezed from a coconut and put into your hair conditioner. They're not disclosing what these are. These are all manipulated things. So the labeling is manipulative, and even when people are telling the truth, there's a chance that they're manipulating the labeling, and yet the labeling is the only chance we have to get a hint, and then other than that, we then have to ask the right questions, which is what?
Mm-hmm.
What do we do?
Well, the first question I ask everyone, and I ask myself, was to take an inventory of all of the chemicals that we are in contact with every day, to whatever extent we can accurately put together an inventory. That would mean when you wake up in the morning, the personal care products that you use, do an inventory, look at all of the ingredients in those products. Do an inventory underneath your sink in your bathroom. Look at whether you use dry cleaning and the dry cleaning fluids that are used.
Your clothing, yeah.
Go through your clothing. Go through, if you have synthetic carpeting, assess that. Look in your kitchen, underneath the sink. Once you start taking an inventory, in the average household, we come in contact with a minimum of 200 to 250 separate chemicals the first hour that we are awake in the mornings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it varies, of course, depending on a person's mindfulness, depending on how educated we are about the threats that exist. But in general, during the course of an entire 24-hour day, we come in contact with upwards of 1,000 or more synthetic chemicals.
Yeah, and we've talked about this on the air some already about, you know, like what a child crawling on a carpet in an indoor air pollution situation is exposed to, you know, starting with the glue in the synthetic carpet and how it never stops outgassing. So, but when you're actually faced with how to shop, you know, it goes back to like in the 80s when people were first discovering environmental illness and people were being treated. I remember that people actually started to use only paper bags when they collected their vegetables. They only put their vegetables in paper bags when they bought them. People would never use any plastic at all. Now everybody's gotten very lax because you can't even buy vitamins in glass very often, or beverages in, you sometimes can, you sometimes can't. Everything's packaged in plastic. So then you rationalize to yourself that it's if it's cold and it's in plastic, you're not activating the plasticizers, and maybe that's not so bad, and we don't know. So it's a question of how much of a Luddite do you become. And for people who are extremely, people who have to live in, you know, trailers in the country who can't go outside, this is not a joke. I mean, they really can't fool around. But for the rest of us, what we're dealing with here is an accumulation of toxic load, some of which you have absolutely no control over because there are things that you've been exposed to on the school ground as a kid, in the schools that you were in that you had no idea, no intention of being exposed to. And even now with the wireless technology and the RFR and the cell phones and the antennas, again, without intending to, you're exposing yourself to another layer of pollutants that your body has to clear and deal with. And it's the overload principle is what gets people sick, because it gets to a point where your liver just can't clear this stuff correctly and you're bioaccumulating. And it happens at different times to different people. But it happens to everybody, and in ways, as you just explained, that are so subtle that people don't even realize they're getting sick. So the question I have then is, you start the book out by saying that you are a libertarian. And I'm wondering, and I don't really have an opinion here, I'm wondering whether you have any different thoughts about regulation based on the research you did, because it's clear that regulation isn't working. It's also clear that if we don't regulate, the cowboys are not going to give us clean things. So it's so where is this coming from, and how do you feel about this politically now?
A bit of a catch-22. What I discovered, and in doing the research for this book, I tried to put aside any of my own conditioning about politics, ideology, et cetera, certainly about whether regulatory reform or regulatory agencies are effective. But what I found in general, and starting with trade secrecy laws, extending on to the regulatory agencies themselves, dealing with, for instance, the FDA and aspartame and how aspartame was approved. If I began to look at the pattern again and again, I would see that regulatory agencies failed us, no matter what the intentions were of the people involved in the agencies. And there are manifest reasons for that occurring. Ultimately, I kept coming back again and again to personal responsibility and personal accountability and consumers taking a proactive approach to chemicals in all aspects of our lives. And I think in particular of some of the cosmetics companies last year, which did begin to take some of the more noxious chemicals out of their products, primarily as a result of breast cancer survivors initiating a public campaign that turned out to be effective. And I see these sorts of campaigns as being not only legitimate, but very necessary in the face of the inability of regulatory agencies over time to actually intervene on behalf of consumers in an effective way.
Jeffrey, you had something?
Well, I have a comment and question, would like a response. As a political economist, there's a well-known principle called regulatory capture, which is pretty easy for us to understand, which is that very soon after any regulatory agency comes into existence, the industry that it's supposed to regulate actually captures it and uses it to its own benefit. And the reason actually makes perfect economic sense, which is that industry is able to collect a tax from all of us when they sell us a product, and they use that tax to pay people to work full-time to influence the decisions of those regulatory agencies. So as citizens and consumers, we have the cards stacked against us. So I want to emphasize what you just said about those campaigns, that our countervailing force that we are able to do is through community organization. So I'm wondering, in terms of the research that you did on this book, where you see community and nonprofit organizations in the scheme of things, of not only pushing back against specific impacts that we're exposed to, but also the more fundamental issue that you raise of having access to information.
Let me just quickly ID the show. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. We're interviewing Randall Fitzgerald, his book, The 100-Year Lie, his website, thehundredyearlie.com. If you still remember the question, I'd like the answer.
Yes, indeed. I think of groups like the Environmental Working Group, do extraordinary research, and that information is widely available to the public through their website. The more that community groups begin to latch on to this very legitimate scientific research and begin to utilize it in positive, proactive social activism, the more we will begin to see a cross-current of change on the part of the behaviors of many of these companies that mindlessly throw chemicals in and hide them under innocuous-sounding labels like trade secrecy laws.
One of the things, incidentally, the Environmental Working Group website is very useful, although it takes a little effort to figure out how to make it work, but it, if you persist, you'll figure it out. It's EWG.org, EWG.org, and it's particularly interesting to plug in chemicals that are in personal care products and see whether you get what kind of a response you get, because some of them are surprising. Sometimes a product that you think is the best product in the world, the cleanest, is not. So it's very interesting to use the website. That said, it brings up a very interesting conundrum, which is that I interviewed someone from there, and they lumped in the same, at the same level of alert, they lumped natural bioidentical progesterone creams that women are using for hormone replacement. These are bioidentical, not synthesized hormones. They lumped that in the same category as coal tar, which is a carcinogen. So in other words, there wasn't a subtlety to some of these issues. So, it, you know, the one of the issues that you bring up in the book is this issue of all of us being educated into believing in a silver bullet because of the drug industry. There's a silver bullet attitude. And in the same way, I think that we digest information in the same way. We just want to know the bottom line. Just tell me what to do. And you can't do that. It just isn't possible to do that. You have to assess all the information and take what's good and discard. You know, you have to say, well, reasonably, I know that there's a lot of research and really good anecdotal experience also that natural bioidentical progesterone protects women from even the xenoestrogens that they're exposed to in hairspray and plastics and whatnot. So it can't be the same as coal tar, and that doesn't mean that you can't use the EWG as a resource. It's just that you have to understand how they're looking at things and, as you say, how questions are being asked. Now, there's a very important other offshoot that this brings up, which is I just interviewed Robert Verkirk from the UK, who is part of the Alliance for Natural Health, who is working in the UK to protect consumers' rights to vitamins. And one of the myths that you bless your heart, expose in the book is the idea that you can get all the nutrients you need from food, and I bravo, bravo. And what's happening is that the pharmaceutical industry and the World Trade Organization and the European Union are all trying to harmonize and regulate how natural food-based substances or originating from food, vitamins and whatnot, are regulated, meaning that people can only take certain amounts, you'll only be, and it'll all become this pharmaceuticalization of nutrients. And the most dangerous thing about it is this reliance on using synthesized, and here I want to make a very important distinction, because in your book it's not clear, that the difference here is between, these are substances that are found in nature, and when they're made in a lab, that they are bioidentical to the ones that your body makes. Because, and that's true of hormones and it's true of vitamins. So, for instance, there was one little thing that I wanted to make clear, and I didn't bring this material down with me, so I have to wing this and remember it by heart, unfortunately, which is that you talk about vitamin C and it coming from cornstarch. The deal with vitamin C and cornstarch is that yes, it's true that there are these pharmaceutical companies that are making vitamins. This is true. And yes, we don't like pharmaceutical companies for a number of reasons, but pharmaceutical-grade vitamins, they can be made to be bioidentical or they can be made to non-bioidentical. So there are forms of vitamin A that are synthetic forms of vitamin A and there are forms of vitamin E. And when those are used in studies, the non and D, and the synthetic forms of these vitamins are toxic and the natural forms are not toxic. Vitamin C, the way it's made, is that they start with cornstarch because they have to make it into glucose. And the glucose is then changed into an acid, which makes ascorbic acid. There isn't anything left of the corn because these are tested as an allergen for people who are allergic to corn. And vitamin C, we no longer have the enzymes in our bodies to make vitamin C this way. We can't turn the sugar into vitamin C anymore, and most domesticated animals can't either. In addition, the vitamin C is best if it's taken with bioflavonoids. So it isn't the case that you have to actually have a vitamin C tablet that's been scraped off the back of an orange. What it means is that the vitamin C has to be in the correct organic milieu, and that can be recreated by adding bioflavonoids to make it natural. So it isn't important that it's produced in a lab. People don't have to go spend extra money to buy so-called food-based, and I can explain why in a moment, but we need to take a brief musical break. So hold that thought, and we'll be right back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, on the air with Jeff Fawcett, and PhD, and also Randall Fitzgerald, the author of The 100-Year Lie, How Food and Medicine Are Destroying Your Health. Please hang tight. We'll be right back after this musical break.
I'm so worried about what's happened today in the Middle East, you know. And I'm so worried about the baggage retrieval system they've got at Heathrow. I'm so worried about the fashions today. I don't think they're good for your feet. And I'm so worried about the shows on TV that sometimes they want to repeat. I'm so worried about what's happening today, you know. And I'm worried about the baggage retrieval system they've got at Heathrow. I'm so...
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm here in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and also Randall Fitzgerald, author of The 100-Year Lie, How Food and Medicine Are Destroying Your Health. His website is thehundredyearlie.com. And if you missed parts of today's show, you can go to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, and listen to it all week long. You'll also find information on the Progressive Health Observer Quarterly and how to get a copy of this or any other in the series. Or you can call us at 707-874-2772. So just to complete the thought about different vitamin supplements, one of the things that's happening that's very difficult for consumers, because again, sorting out all of this information and having personal responsibility requires a lot of education. So in view of that, to educate people a little bit about vitamin supplements, food-based vitamins that are sold in stores, when you go to a store and they have, you know, they say there's this pharmaceutical grade stuff and then there's the food-based, it isn't possible extracting from, for instance, a B vitamin from Bruges yeast, which is the most robust amount of, it isn't possible to get enough vitamin D to make it even a viable amount. And even so, the food-based vitamins are like 10 milligrams of a certain vitamin B. And even at 10 milligrams, that still isn't going to be possible to extract from yeast to get enough of it. So they are adding synthesized. I guarantee they are adding, and I talked to somebody who's very reliable in the industry. They are, in fact, adding synthesized or so-called pharmaceutical-grade bioidentical vitamin B. So if you are eating food with your vitamins, you're getting the enzymes that you need. If you're substituting them for food, then you're not. But it's very important to understand that there's a lot of manipulation that goes on, even in the vitamin trade. And if we just draw lines between, oh, pharmaceutical grade, I have to say also that for people who are very allergic and very food sensitive, the pharmaceutical grade who are bioidentical, and you do have to know the forms of the vitamins that are natural, like D3 instead of D2, and you have to do your homework. But those vitamins shouldn't be a problem. And in fact, some of the research you cite, some of the remarkable research of Stephen Scholenthaler and the other two people who are doing the type of research on violent behavior and nutrient deficiencies, were using regular pharmaceutical grade vitamins, as much of the research is. So, do you have a comment?
You're far more knowledgeable about vitamins.
That's
than
really
I am.
The only reason I did that. You know,
yeah. I am way in over my head in connection with vitamins. I would like to take that as a starting point, though, and ask you a question about cofactors and naturally occurring synergies and the impact of cofactors, especially in food, to strengthen the immune system. Since really, when we're talking about vitamins and minerals, we're talking about keeping our immune systems strong.
Well, even more than the immune system, what we're looking at is the detoxification pathways. And this was I really liked your book. I think it's a very, very good book for people to have on their bookshelves. And I note that at the end of the book, you, because you were kind of building up the fact that, that toxins are stored in animal fat, that you were kind of headed toward the direction of you can detox by avoiding animal products for a while, and I was reassured that you're not still a raw foodist, even though, you know, everything works for some people. And if people are finding this works for them, then I can't argue. But there are reasons for concern, because the real way that you're, well, real way, if you look physiologically at how the body, if you look biochemically how the body detoxifies, it isn't from washing your colon or avoiding certain foods. It has more to do with creating a good environment for your liver to be able to produce the main detoxification chemical, which is called glutathione. And that is produced with the metabolism of sulfur-containing amino acids, which are found in meat. Now, that isn't to say that a vegetarian who eats some eggs or has some milk or whatever, or takes the right complement of amino acids and other vitamins that are missing from animal-based proteins, couldn't recreate this milieu. But the other problem is that chemicals themselves, as you mentioned, change our DNA and cause DNA mutations that are genetically passed on. You mentioned this in the book. And those DNA mutations cause nutrient pathways to get destroyed. And the nutrient pathways that are being destroyed are the ones that work for detoxification. So you're looking at B12, and you're looking at preferably a hydroxy or methyl cobalamin rather than a cyanocobalamin, which is based on cyanide. You're looking at folic acid, which is a B vitamin, robust amounts of it. You're looking at possibly also making sure that vitamin K and vitamin D are robust in the body. You're looking at all the antioxidants that boost glutathione production, since taking glutathione often isn't a fast track to boosting glutathione. And you're also looking at vitamins and minerals that boost and aid the production of, you know, help the liver to function. So you've got, in fact, the healthiest food for the liver is liver. It, of course, has to be as close to organic as you can find. But you know, your omega-3 fatty acids, substantial amounts of undamaged and hopefully as close to organic saturated fat as you can find, because without the saturated fat, you can't utilize all of your fat-soluble vitamins. So all your antioxidants like A and D and all in the E need the saturated fat, need the oils. In addition, there are antioxidants now that have been isolated, like alpha-lipoic acid and CoQ10, and other nutrients which are synergistic with it, like carnitine, which is found in red meat, that although can be taken as a pharmaceutical-grade vitamin, that all boost these pathways. But again, the sulfur-containing amino acids like methionine and cysteine, and there are several others too, but these are absolutely essential for the liver to do its job. The problem that I see with people who become raw foodists and stay raw foodists, although some people, I clearly, the ones that are really healthy are not coming to see me, but the ones that do come to see me are deficient in these pathways. And often, you know, I read another book recently where they were talking about people presenting with no, or I was looking at a CD, so a DVD of somebody presenting, that their colon was clean and their this was going and their vitamin status was good and they didn't feel good. Because there's energetically other things that have to go on. So the body is a very complex dance, and the cofactors, as you say, and the enzymes and the nutrients come from this organic milieu or this confluence of nutrients working together, just as you point out so astutely in your book, that the chemicals work synergistically. So I pass that ball to you about the synergistic dangerous effects of the chemicals, how it isn't just staying away from fragrances. It's this working with this, with the fluoride working with the xenoestrogens working with the this and the that.
Synergy is a principle of nature. We are synergistic beings. Thoughts are a byproduct of synergistic processes. Digestion is a byproduct. We could go on and on. What manufacturers and the regulatory agencies don't want to look at is the emerging toxic threat of synthetic chemical synergies. It is a Pandora's box. It undermines all of our public health standards. It undermines the idea that the poison is in the dose. which has been used by the pharmaceutical industry for decades to reassure the public. We have the mass marketing of all of these drugs. They come off the assembly lines, and they're designed for everyone, when in actuality, as we all know, we're all different. We all metabolize differently. We're all different beings in many different respects, and the pharmaceutical industry cannot and will not recognize that. So synergies are an inherent problem for government, because government cannot even begin to come up with the resources or the technology at this stage to begin to measure synergies and the impact of synergies. What few studies we have seen over the last couple of years that have looked at synergies are very alarming. One in particular, a few months ago, the University of Liverpool in England did a study looking at four common food additives, aspartame, MSG, and two food colorings, to see what the synergistic interaction of those four chemicals, which is common in just about every junk food marketed to children in this country, what the effect would be, and they found widespread nerve damage in all of the animals that were tested with this combination. So is it any wonder that we're seeing this upsurge in cases of childhood problems, behavioral and otherwise? I would say that synergies are, for the 21st century, the looming public health problem.
Well, and you know, it's notable that when Steven Scholenthaler first started doing his research, his 20-year research, which has been largely ignored by the industry and medical establishment, he started out by just removing colorings and junk food and saw a remarkable effect before adding the vitamins. Aspartame forms methyl alcohol at unacceptable amounts, really high amounts. In combination with that and other things, I think you can form formaldehyde.
It converts to formaldehyde.
Do either of you remember some of the other synergistic effects that people are getting exposed to without meaning to? Do you remember any of them? Citing any of them?
Everyone in the world now carries some burden of PCBs in their body fat. And PCBs synergistically act with bisphenol A and phthalates.
Right, which is plastics.
Which is plastics. Bisphenol A is the substance that hardens, makes hard plastic products, and phthalates make soft plastic products.
Well, and it's interesting to note that the bisphenol A is in your white fillings. You know, I remember when I was facing the idea of getting some of these fillings replaced, my old silver fillings, because God bless him, my father was a dentist, so I have a mouthful of silver fillings. And I started doing the research, and I realized that we don't know anything about the long-term effect of the plastics that we're putting in our teeth. We don't know what the effect is going to be over time of these lingering. And sure enough, there isn't one that doesn't have bisphenol A in it. They all do. So I guess part of what we're saying here, Randall, is that we're coming forward into the world out of our mother's wombs with a toxic burden. And then we're adding on top of that. And the problem is education, because prudent avoidance doesn't always buy you real avoidance, because your products are lying to you. One thing that I think is very important for people to do is to get really cynical and go beyond looking at labels. And some of that can be done by looking at your book, The 100-Year Lie, because you have a lot of research in there. But making good decisions is partly, you know, kind of knowing your terrain, as we were talking about, knowing, as you say, what you came in with, and also what your genetic load is going to be like. Is it heart disease that fattens your family? Is it digestive problems? Is it cancer? What are the problems? And then you can begin to know how to work with those pathways as you educate yourself. But beyond that, you have to know that there's no free lunch, that every time you buy a product, it behooves you to avoid as much of those chemicals as you can. So to educate yourself, what are some other good resources for educating yourself beyond your book? What did you find? Do you have other good websites beside the EWG.org?
Yes, quite a few. And you mentioned raw food. The Hippocrates Health Institute and the Optimum Health Institutes in San Diego and Austin are good resources. I discovered their websites have quite a bit of good material for people who are looking at ways to link their symptoms with particular chemicals.
So they don't just bottom line at all that everybody has to just eat raw foods to get better?
They are becoming more and more resource guides.
Oh, that would be great. So the Hippocrates Institute.
Yes, they are dealing more and more with chemical sensitivity cases.
I just want to remind people you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with health educator Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD, and with author and journalist Randall Fitzgerald. His book, The 100-Year Lie, How Food and Medicine Are Destroying Your Health, is on the bookshelves as we speak, available for any bookseller, online or otherwise. And his website, again, is the100yearlie.com. You, at the beginning of the book, said that a good principle that you learned from writing this book is not all synthetics are toxic to us, and not all natural occurring substances from nature are benign. Can you unpack that a little for us?
Yes. We're all guinea pigs in our own personal experiment of life, and that applies in multiple ways. And we're certainly all guinea pigs in this vast chemical experiment that I call the synthetics belief system, which, ironically enough, began 100 years ago this week with the establishment of the FDA and the passage by Congress of the first Pure Food and Drug Act. So we were given certain assurances about the safety of our foods and our medicines. And we know that nature has its own toxins. It can deliver everything from arsenic to naturally occurring mercury, go down the list. So nature is not entirely benign. But for the most part, what I noticed by way of patterns and research in this book is that most naturally occurring foods and medicines from nature have been something that we've adapted to during evolutionary time. The synthetics, for the most part, are something we have not adapted to and may never be able to adapt to unless we become a mutant species, unless we mutate in ways to where we begin to process synthetics, which our livers currently do not recognize as something that can be processed.
Well, an example of that is herbal medicine, which when you standardize or remove the active ingredient and produce a drug, or you produce a drug that's based on the active ingredient, that the effect of it is not going to be the same because of that concept of synergy that you talked about. Well, what about the other one, which is not all synthetic substances are bad for you?
And I use that as a general rule. For some people, all synthetics may be bad for them. We ultimately have to experiment and determine what is good and bad for us. I'm hesitant to make a broad generalization, as in all synthetics are bad and all naturally occurring are good. And I'm trying to hedge my bets to some extent as a researcher in connection with what is and what isn't.
Well, it's also difficult to know, as we just pointed out earlier in the show, it isn't possible to isolate sort of vitamins, for instance, which you say you must have. You're not going to get it all from food. Let's be realistic. So you need the vitamins, and even the ones that are supposed to be food-based are still going to go into a lab and make this. If nothing else, one of the ways to think of this is that we couldn't possibly make enough vitamins for everybody, including people who are lower income, if these things weren't possible to make in the lab, if we weren't able to. But the rule is, does it match the molecular structure of what nature did? Are you using nature as your model? And are you looking at the use of herbs and vitamins and homeopathic remedies, and, you know, where you're using metals and toxins at very low doses, are you looking at the synergy between these things and your body?
Mm-hmm. And how this morning in the San Francisco Chronicle, there's a front page article about traditional Chinese medicine and the use of herbs. And even though the word synergy isn't one that's used in mainstream media, it popped through implicitly in this article, the combinations of herbs that were being used with great effect, based on the interviews done with many patients that were using these combinations of herbs, was a synergistic, naturally occurring effect that has been mastered over many thousands of years by that particular tradition.
You betcha. You know, another thing that you talk about is you do a lot of myth busting, which I love, actually, and you go down a hole. There's a whole bunch of them. We've already talked about some of them. One dose for everybody, you know, trust the experts. food has all the vitamins we need. One we haven't talked about is vaccinations protect your health, which if people have been listening to my show probably know isn't so true. And one of the other ones you bring up is that you need drugs for depression, that depression only responds. It's this very mysterious biochemical. So we have these research projects by Schollenthaler and the two other people whose names I don't have committed to memory that were smaller studies that show that nutrient deficiencies. And you go back to Abram Hoffer in the 40s and 50s using niacin and various things for depression. Another one is this idea, and it rears its ugly head in research projects as an excuse for things, and they also remove this out of the thing, is the placebo effect. And, you know, it's so interesting that we can't accept that the placebo effect is a real thing, that Yes. It isn't, it the word, when they say placebo, it isn't, what we really should do is find another term for this.
Yes, because placebos do heal.
Yes.
It's a mind-body interaction.
Right.
It's a synergy.
Right.
And it's interesting, in connection with traditional Chinese medicine, the point was made again in this article about the placebo effect, the extent to which it's really the mind, it's not really the herbs. Well, I contend that it's all together. It's the combinations of herbs enhanced by the belief that this will work.
Yeah, this is energetic medicine.
Yes, energetic medicine. And the fact that medical science has relegated the placebo to something to contrast with animals in animal studies, and that beyond that it has no value, indicates the limitations of the current medical science paradigm.
Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I've noted before on the show is that there is a part of standard experimental practice that's called the placebo washout, which is that you take a population of people, and before you even start applying a drug one way or another, you give them all placebos, and anyone who reacts positively, you take them out of the study because they've showed improvement. And it just astounds me that that doesn't prompt anyone's curiosity as to what just happened. What we want to see is whether the drug works or not. It's this monomaniacal focus on the chemical and its effect.
A study was done in Israel last year, a survey of more than 1,000 physicians to determine whether they used the placebo effect. And it was found that nearly 60% of the physicians in Israel use placebos all the time in their daily practice. They have simply found it effective to give sugar pills with some interesting sounding name on the label instead of the actual pharmaceutical, because of, first of all, they're concerned about the pharmaceuticals and the effectiveness and the toxicity, but secondly, because they're discovering firsthand that people have a positive effect as a result of just their belief.
I think that people completely forget about that effect in healing, and there are many examples. I mean, I often sometimes wonder while I'm dosing myself with 9,000 different substances to fight a cold or something whether what I'm really doing is just keeping my mind busy and reassuring myself while my body does its work. In other words, one of the possibilities is to get out of the way of your own body's innate healing capacity, and some of it may be to add things in, and some of it may be to get out of the way. There's a wonderful story, and I can't remember where I got it from, but it was some interview that I did, where a woman was a rather wealthy woman, but very isolated and alone at this point of life, a mature woman, became fatally ill, I mean, just desperately terminally ill, and was in hospitals and getting worse and worse and worse. And some Southeast Asian people who worked for her found out she was ill, came into the hospital, took her out of the hospital with her permission, took her home, nurtured her, and fed her whole, soups and stews and good whole foods and all this kind of stuff. And the woman recovered and lived a good long time. And she was not expected to live. But the combination of just the healthy food and nurturing really made a difference. I've often said I've had several relatives say, stay away from doctors, they'll kill you, that kind of thing. But obviously that isn't true of all doctors. But I think that there's a very important issue here with, we've moved so far from the family doctor who came to your house and put his hand on your, or her hand, well, it was usually a man in those years, but hand on your head and I remember once having terrible stomach spasms, and the family doctor came over and gave me a shot of brandy and determined that I was traumatized by something and upset and that I needed to relax, and it stopped the spasms. So just sitting with me and calming down. So, you know, that sort of medicine is what we can all do for each other. You end the book with a consumer action plea, your five societal changes worth supporting. These look dangerously like regulation to me.
No, it could be self-regulation, too. I mean, we all have to regulate our behavior in various ways and discipline ourselves in various ways just to be survivors in this society. And the key action points that I felt were necessary for society really, in many respects, I hope, are just common sense.
Like?
Well, for instance, restaurants and menus. I eat out a lot, and I would like to know the contents of my food, the ingredients. I would like to have a clear idea of exactly what I am consuming at all times. This is education. This is information. And the access to it, I think, is our right as consumers. And if we begin to demand it of restaurants, the people that own restaurants, they eat too. As soon as their awareness level is raised, perhaps we will start getting the sort of information we deserve and need.
I actually call ahead so I don't irritate my my friends and family. I call ahead and ask them these pointed questions, and they go back to the kitchen and ask. The thing I often do, too, is just say, just cook this really simply. Don't add any. If you have any questions, don't add it.
You know? Give you a good example. There's a Chinese restaurant I go to, and so many people have demanded that there be no MSG in their food, that this restaurant has totally reversed what was generations of the use of MSG and will no longer add it to any of its dishes.
Yeah, it works. Consumer pressure. So we are out of time, and you've been a remarkably nice guest, and thank you for coming in live to the studio.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
This is Randall Fitzgerald, spelled like it sounds, F-I-T-Z-G-E-R-A-L-D, his book, The 100-Year Lie, How Food and Medicine Are Destroying Your Health and My Voice. And his website is thehundredyearlie.com. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information, or if you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, or the Progressive Health Observer Quarterly, go to the website, where you can also listen to the show all week long for free. You can also hear one of our archive shows there as well. YourOwnHealthAndFitness.org, YourOwnHealthAndFitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Dev Ross. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.